Today in Studio 360, the X-Files confirm the dark hunches of millions of conspiracists. More than a dozen years since it was on the air, it's coming back. And people are now even more ready and willing to believe.
One night by a lake, it was way out in the country, it was very dark, and I saw five craft in a V pattern slowly fly over me. It was unidentified to me, I guess. Yeah.
We meet real people channeling Mulder and Scully later this hour. Plus, sure, you can put a painting in a museum or record a song, but how do you preserve a dance? The superstar choreographer Twyla Tharp is on it.
By age 26, I'd been working already and making dances since I was 4 years old.
That and lots more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start the show, the new movie Victoria opens with a scene of a young woman dancing in a nightclub. She looks happy and carefree, but as the camera follows her out of the club and onto the streets of Berlin, she finds herself on an adventure that at first seems funny, then romantic, then harrowing, and finally terrifying. And it all unfolds in a single shot, a single long, winding, virtuosic take. One camera nonstop in real time for more than 2 hours in buildings and on streets and in cars all over the city. It is a thrilling ride. The whole movie feels like some remarkable love child of an action blockbuster and a tiny independent movie, which is exactly what the director Sebastian Schipper had in mind.
You know, if I get megalomaniac, if that word exists, you
close
know,
enough.
If I'm going to shoot a film in one take, why not like also take the best of two worlds I love about cinema? And that for me is that in independent movies and smaller movies, I love the characters. You know, the characters get some space. We get to know them. They can be a little awkward. They're not just cut out two-dimensional, one-dimensional, but they can be full, you know, real characters. But on the other hand, I really like genre stuff. You know, I want to be entertained. I want stuff to happen.
Yeah, I like
action and all that. So it is about a heist, but it's also about these people, you know. So, I mean, of course, the tentpole information about this film is one take heist. But maybe that doesn't describe the heart of this film. Because it's about friendship and falling in love and being crazy.
Actually, I was afraid of giving a spoiler by saying it's about a heist, but you just did. So let's talk about that. I read somewhere that you have fantasized about robbing a bank. And I guess I have, too. But have you done that a lot?
Have I fantasized about it a lot?
Yeah.
Lately, not that much anymore.
Well, no, you slaked your fantasy. But was this a thing you thought about?
To be honest, you know, I was... This is my fourth film.
Right.
And I worked, like a couple of years back, I worked on a script forever. And, you know, I was sitting at my desk with my computer and I was going into my fifth year.
Fifth year working on a script.
Yes, it can happen. It happens. It happens actually a lot. So I was sitting there at my desk, you know, with my notes and my laptop. And it felt like, man, this is your life now. It kind of feels like back at school. I thought like being a filmmaker and writing your own scripts can be a little more. So my mind, you know, your mind does anything to get away from the writing. It sort of wandered off. And I thought like, what else could I do with my mind? And I thought like, I rob a bank with two friends. And of course I knew I'm not going to do it, you know. But then I thought, but you're a filmmaker. Why just make a film about it? And honestly, the first thing that came to my mind was like, because it, like, I thought about writing a script again and then getting it financed and then shooting it. It was just, I had the feeling making a film about it and doing it, there's such a humongous gap between those two things that, and somewhere from there sprung the idea that, you know, can shoot it in one take maybe.
It's a long movie, which would ordinarily mean 140-page script. Your script for this was 12 pages long. What is in a 12-page script for
it just
two and a half
a,
hours?
It just tells a story. It tells a story, but it tells what's going on. And it also...
Scene by scene.
Yeah, it wasn't scenes. You know, the thing is, this was the heart and soul of the work on this film was oral. You know, I mean, honestly, one actor, the bald guy, early on, he said, oh, I didn't get those 12 pages. And I was like furious with the production. Why didn't he get those pages? And then later on, I found out he's always the guy who didn't get something. He just didn't open up the mail or the attachment. I'm sure Boxer, the bald guy, he never read anything.
Huh.
All the information he got is by what I told him. And that's not the worst for actors. That's not the worst way to do it. Of course, the film is improvised. You know, the dialogue is improvised.
Entirely.
Yes. But every improvisation needs a lot of preparation.
Sure.
You know, just like in music, people got to show up with different instruments and kind of agree on what kind of an improv is this going to be. Is this going to be free jazz or
right.
is this going to be rock and roll or punk
right.
or something?
Right. Right.
And we did like 10 days of rehearsals.
So you rehearsed you rehearsed it on location.
Right.
You had that. You shot it more than once. You shot it three times?
Yes.
You didn't have what you wanted after the first one? You didn't have what you wanted after the second one?
Oh, no, I did not. It was honestly, between the first and the second, there were 10 days. And between the second and the third, there was like 48 hours. And those 48 hours, you know, I'm 47 now.
Uh-huh.
So I've been pretty much, more or less, been doing this for 30 years. And I'm telling you, these 48 hours have been the worst time of my creative life.
I can imagine.
Because the first one was really controlled and lame.
Even though you got through all the scenes and told the story.
But nobody wanted to mess it up. You know, nobody wanted to be the fool, to say a really nice word, who messed it up. And so I said, guys, come on, you go crazy. You don't be afraid of mistakes. And they did. And it was horrible. It's like the improv.
So that was the second one.
That was the second one.
The pendulum swung too far.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So horrible 48 hours. I have the financing for one more shooting night.
Right.
I have to figure this out in 48 hours. So let's go through that night. So it's like you're about to do it. It's 3 a.m. or whatever. You're about to start shooting. Just logistically, did you block off streets? Did you block
off? We basically did not. I don't even think we blocked off one street.
Wow. And nobody walked into the shots or started like throwing bottles at you or anything?
Thank God. Yeah, throwing bottles. That would have been. No, I mean, it was early in the morning.
I mean, that must have been one of the reasons you set it between 4 and 6, right?
Right. And we also, that's also one of the reasons why the club you see in the film is built. You know, it's a set. We made that.
Oh,
club.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And, but having said that, you know, it wasn't a classical film set. Loud music, all the extras. I mean, there were British tourists walking into our set and ordering a beer while we were shooting because there was no... They couldn't see. Of course, there was somewhere there was a guy with a camera.
Yeah.
But they thought, this is a club where there's a guy with a camera somewhere.
So these main actors, these five main actors show up at various locations over the course of the film where there are other actors they have to interact with. So those secondary actors are warned by phone like, okay, they're going to be there in 3 minutes.
Yeah, walkies. It was like a surveillance FBI kind of thing, you know, the actors couldn't see anybody. But they were always been watched and there was a constant communication. Okay, they're coming out of the bar now. Okay, they're on that corner. Okay, they're going. They're coming towards you. Blah, blah, blah.
For you, I mean, just the tension that you must have felt is unimaginable to me.
I mean, let's face it. That night, there was a film god on watch. I sometimes have a feeling it was like an old hippie. That was like a little bit going like, let's have those kids have it. Yeah, I was young.
That's funny. and so as soon as you were done, you knew it worked. It must have just been an insane catharsis release.
Yes, but I was not there. I wasn't behind the camera at every moment. So I knew the stuff I saw looked very good.
Uh-huh.
But I also knew there was stuff I didn't see.
Oh, so there could have been problems.
We stopped shooting 7 in the morning and then around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, something. You know, we took the little chip out of the camera and put in some computer and screened it and watched it. And only then did I was crying. Yeah, you know, I was just out of pure nerve. I was overwhelmed. I was also overwhelmed, I have to say, because, you know, a little bit like maybe I composed this music or I was the coach that invented this new kind of football or whatever you want to call it. But to see them doing it, that's a whole different thing.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a whole different thing.
Was it hard to resist? Were there better takes from version one and version two that you wished you could have stuck in?
I always thought that anticipating this thing that, you know, I would die a thousand deaths because in one take the beginning is great and the other take the ending is great. And honestly, if that would have been the case, I would have cut, you know, and I would have said, this is a cut.
Really?
Yeah.
You weren't that committed to the principle?
This business is called entertainment. And it's my job to entertain people, honestly. And I would have said, we shot this three times. There's two cuts in it.
Okay.
I would have. That's what I'm saying. The craziness is, in all the three takes, every single scene, the best I've ever seen it is in this last take.
You are also an actor. Have been a successful actor. Did that come in handy in any new way with this bizarre operation?
I think so very much. I love actors, and I know they're crazy, and I know that can be a pain in the butt. But I mean, look at it. I mean, what's the career of most actors? They're being admired at the beginning of their career. You know, it's like an animal that's really beautiful, has like really shiny, colorful feathers.
Yeah.
And the next thing the animal knows, it's in a cage called a trailer. So they're sitting in their trailer, and then they're being led to set, the circus, do their number, and being brought back into their cage.
Yeah.
And of course they go crazy. You know, I have a heart for them.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I, so one of the essential ideas of this is like, come out of your trailers, guys. Let's do something.
Be wild animals?
Yeah. Be the animals you want to be, you know. Of course, that I tell them. Of course, I'm still the director with the whip.
So did you learn anything from doing this bizarre and successful thing that will be applicable to, like, your next project?
Yes. I think scripts are overrated. And of course, that's a shock and that's a little cocky to say that. But I think there is too much – what is important is the story. And what I'm saying is, I think we can't neglect the process of filmmaking. It can't be eliminated by working on the book forever and streamlining it.
And reassuring everybody that we've got this down.
Right. And, I don't like that he says that.
This is your fourth feature as a director. And you've said about it, if I were a musician, this is the first album that sounds like me where we didn't copy our favorite band. Why is that so?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's really, I mean, it's hard, you know. When you start out, you copy. I think you do that as a singer or if you're a musician.
As anything,
you know, that's, you copy your idols. And then and I think in film, because it's such a expensive enterprise, you know, if you play your guitar, it's already hard to develop your own voice.
Right.
But in the midst of this, all this anxiety that the money's going to get lost, you know, and on any level, you know, not just on the big studio levels, like on any level, the amount of money that goes in is going to be a lot of money for the people that are spending that money.
Right.
So you copy and I think that's a lot what we see, you know, it's a lot of reference going on. It's a film like Godfather a little bit. It's a film like Bourne Identity a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a film like 2001 a little bit. And what that means is it's not as good.
Right.
And one of the ideas for Victoria was to get away from the reference.
Make a new thing.
Yeah.
Well, I was so impressed by this, and I'm now eager to see your past movies and your future ones. So congratulations.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Victoria is playing in various cities in America right now. What a pleasure.
That was 45 minutes. Amazing.
We can cut it. We did talk for 45 minutes, but unlike Sebastian Shipper's film, our conversation was edited for air. You can hear the whole thing, though, at studio360.org. Fans, including certain members of my own family, are flipping out that The X-Files is about to return to television. Is it just 90s nostalgia, or are Americans ready for Mulder and Scully again now more than ever?
They police us and spy on us, tell us that makes us safer. We've never been in more danger.
Then do something about it, Mulder.
That is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. To me, it's dispiriting enough that Hollywood is compulsive about doing reboots and remakes of movies and TV shows. Okay, yes, I'm eager to see the first Star Wars in a decade, the seventh one, in December. But The X-Files. In January, it's returning as a six-episode miniseries. And every casting update and teaser trailer has provoked a million tweets and blog posts. In my opinion, too many Americans already believe in too many loony conspiracy theories, but maybe that's just me. So I asked Studio 360's Eric Molinsky to find out if this new X-Files mania really is tapping into the zeitgeist again.
In case you never watched The X-Files, and I sure did, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson played Fox Mulder and Dana Scully, FBI agents that were assigned to paranormal cases. He was the believer, she was the skeptic. They were also on a quest to unravel a massive conspiracy between shady government officials and mostly unseen aliens that were preparing the Earth for colonization.
Who is this Deep Throat character? I mean, we don't know anything about him.
He's in a delicate position. He has access to information, and indiscretion could expose him.
He's toying with you, rationing out the facts.
You think he does it because he gets off on it?
No. I think he does it because you do.
Joe Yuzinski teaches political science at the University of Miami, and he wrote a book called American Conspiracy Theories. And this is why he thinks The X-Files attracted 20 million viewers at its height.
The X-Files started in the fall of 1993, which is a really neat time for conspiracy theories. You know, only 2 years prior to that, JFK came out, which was a huge movie, and it broke a lot of ground in terms of conspiracy narratives.
The magic bullet enters the president's back, headed downward at an angle of 17 degrees. It then moves upward in order to leave Kennedy's body from the front of his neck. Wound number two.
Fox was sort of a fledgling network still at that time, and they were trying to reach younger viewers at that time who were Gen Xers. They were coming of age in the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and during that period you had Watergate, you had all sorts of real conspiracies coming out about the CIA, and then you had Iran-Contra. So you have this whole zeitgeist.
I definitely fit that demo. When I was in high school, I bought two sets of trading cards at a comic book store. One had satirical cartoons of the Reagan administration officials who were allegedly involved in the Iran-Contra affair, and the other had all the alleged conspirators of the Kennedy assassination. By the time Oliver Stone's movie came out, I knew those characters by heart. And of course, The X-Files showed us that Kennedy's real assassin was their main villain, who we only knew as Cigarette-Smoking Man, or Cancer Man.
It is official now. President Kennedy is dead.
But I've been wondering lately, what did people think of The X-Files, who were really committed to uncovering conspiracies, more than buying trading cards at a comic book store? So I contacted a group called Want to Know, and they suggested that I talk with one of their members, John Lumiere Wins. I was kind of hoping that John would meet me in a dark alley wearing a trench coat, and then when I asked him why he was helping me, he'd say, "Trust no one, Molinsky," and then he'd disappear into a black car with tinted windows, which is pretty much how most of the exposition happened on The X-Files. But John's office was in very sunny Northern California. He works in alternative medicine. There's mood lighting and all sorts of stuff to relax you when you step in there.
I had been exploring what's been going on this planet, kind of behind the scenes and behind the corporate media. And I had discovered that there were a lot of things that have been happening that people were ignorant of, and the X-Files revealed some of that stuff, so that I really liked. I had no way of getting it out there like that.
Like what kind of stuff?
Oh, boy. Extraterrestrial stuff, UFO stuff. I've seen craft.
That's what I was wondering, whether you saw something that made you, you know.
Yeah, I was one night, it was like by a lake. It was way out in the country. It was very dark. And I saw five craft in a, a V pattern, slowly fly in a direction across the sky right above me. No sound. I'd never seen anything like it before. I took it. It was unidentified to me.
The X-Files had two mottos. I want to believe, and the truth is out there. I Want to Believe cover the wondrous stuff. Ghosts, aliens, ESP. Things that, you know, if they were true, it would mean that there's more to the world than what's in front of us, which sounds kind of wonderful. But then there's the sort of Dana Scully character in my head saying, don't be a dupe, where's the evidence? The Truth is Out There covered the horrible stuff, the things we wish we didn't know. On the show, much of it was fantastical, but it usually mirrored real cover-ups like the Tuskegee experiments.
There's been enough of the alleged conspiracy theories that have turned out to be pretty obviously true that people suspect. They don't believe the mainstream media anymore.
Lindsay Ellis is a pop culture critic, and she thinks the character of Fox Mulder made it acceptable, even romantic, to be a conspiracy theorist.
Because I think Mulder, you know, he's weird, but just weird enough. So he was relatable, but at the same time, he was also kind of a hero, especially by nature of the fact that he does get vindicated so constantly.
What do you know about the Gulf War syndrome?
Agent Orange of the 90s.
Artillery shells coated with depleted uranium.
What about UFO activity during that period?
Yeah, UFOs caused the Gulf War syndrome. That's a good one.
That's why we like you, Mulder. Your ideas are weirder than ours.
Now, Mulder also consulted with a group of really quirky conspiracy theorists called the Lone Gunmen that were so popular, they had their own very short-lived spinoff series in the spring of 2001.
Yeah, the pilot for the Lone Gunmen involved a government conspiracy to fly airplanes into the Twin Towers.
The Cold War's over, John. But with no clear enemy to stockpile against, the arms market's flat. But bring down a fully loaded 727 into the middle of New York City, and you'll find a dozen tin pot dictators all over the world just clamoring to take responsibility.
I mean, that's eerie, right? And, you know, there was a period after 9/11 when conspiracy theories seemed unpalatable, and we were willing to grant the government massive new powers. Then came Abu Ghraib, Edward Snowden. Conspiracy theories seemed to come back with a vengeance.
You know, the fact that we have these figureheads that have like hundreds of thousands of followers, people like Alex Jones and David Icke. And, you know, and the fact that me even like saying their names is going to put me on like a bunch of Twitter lists.
I knew about birthers and truthers, but I had to look those guys up. Apparently, David Icke believes that our reptilian overlords are already here among us. If The X-Files were not a revival and were actually coming out as a brand new show in January, Mulder couldn't be a lone wolf anymore. In fact, it would be hard for him to convince everybody that his conspiracy was the real one. Now, Professor Joe Yuzinski studies conspiracy theories, and he says the internet has a way of making them seem more prevalent than they actually are. And most of the media coverage is negative.
Yes, we are talking a lot more about conspiracy theories, but we're treating them like zoo animals.
But he doesn't treat them that way. In fact, he thinks there is something heroic about the real-life Fox Mulders.
We have a media out there that doesn't always question authority figures, that don't always question our big, powerful institutions. And that role then gets passed on to conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists who push those questions, who demand more information. The 9/11 Commission would not have been out there unless it was really driven by conspiracy theorists who were asking questions about, hey, what really happened and how come we haven't been told everything? And Nixon would never have been caught if it wasn't for two cheeky conspiracy theorists working at the Washington Post who said, hey, I have a conspiracy theory. We think that the president might be involved in covering up some stuff.
You know, it's often said that people who believe in conspiracy theories want to believe that somebody's in charge, even if that somebody is evil. And I get that. You know, a world without conspiracies is just totally chaotic. And in that story, human beings with great ambitions are undone by petty little flaws or unresolved childhood issues, which lead to catastrophes that they didn't expect and they can't clean up. I mean, to me, the scariest story is the one where the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And again, that is just the kind of thing that Scully would say to Mulder right before he proved her wrong. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
The X-Files returns to Fox in January for 6 episodes, and you can hear more of Eric's stories about the fantastic and science fictional on his podcast, Imaginary Worlds.
During the spookiest time of the year, there are a few guidelines all ghosts and goblins should follow. Always stay on sidewalks. Never go to a stranger's house. And never go out alone.
My producers are eating candy corn like it's going out of style, which can only mean one thing. They have dental coverage. And Halloween is imminent. If you've been to our Facebook page, you may have seen a picture of my colleague Sean Ramisferum in full Batman costume. Some of us at Studio 360 take Halloween very seriously. I remember only two of my childhood Halloween get-ups, a pirate one year, and when I was really small, a skeleton. A store-bought skeleton, black cotton printed with white bones. My mom put some black and white stage makeup on my face, and I thought I was pretty scary. But I wouldn't have frightened Jack Handy.
I suppose we all have the same dream. 100 years from now, a man carrying a lantern enters a darkened tomb. He's already nervous, and he hears something behind him. He turns and holds up the lantern. It's a hideous skeleton. Speechless with fear, he stumbles backwards. He trips, dropping the lantern. The oil spills and catches him on fire. A flailing fireball, he runs from the tomb into the night. You may be asking, why do they still have oil lanterns 100 years from now? Look, I think you're missing the point. The point is, after you die, you want a scary skeleton. You don't want to be discovered by a grave robber or an archaeologist or a jogger and have the guy shrug and go, well, here's another one. Why a scary skeleton? First of all, because it's scary. It scares people. If a skeleton's not scary, what's the point of even having one? Also, scariness can actually protect your skeleton. Something like half of all skeletons are eventually dug up and sold. Some go to medical schools or are taken apart and used as musical instruments. Even worse, many wind up in teenagers' bedrooms, where they are propped up in chairs with funny hats, smoking a cigarette. Remember, a scary skeleton is a safe skeleton. But scary skeletons don't just pop out of the ground. Or if they do, a lot of planning was involved. Some people make the mistake of thinking that just because they're hideous in life, their skeletons will be hideous. Unfortunately, that's a myth. There are no easy skeletons. Probably the most obvious way to make your skeleton scarier is to gradually distort your bones into grotesque shapes while you're still alive using a series of heavy vices and clamps. But this is not as easy as it sounds. You may just end up with an expensive set of clamps. The truth is, the time to consider this method is probably when you're young and your bones pliable. But most people don't even think about their skeletons then. They're too busy going, oh, let's play hide and seek, or oh, where's my dolly? An easier, more practical alternative might be to have your eyeballs injected with some sort of preservative after you're dead. That way your skeleton will have intact eyeballs, which is very scary. You may be wondering if, in addition to preservatives, some sort of insect larvae could be injected in your eyes, so that worms or whatever could wiggle out. I think maybe you're overthinking it. The odds of that happening at the exact right moment are almost nil. To me, the best ideas are simple. This guy I met in a bar said to just bury the body with a knife in its hand. A skeleton holding up a knife is pretty scary. But wouldn't the knife just fall out of the guy's hand by the time he turned into a skeleton, said this other guy in the bar? But then the bartender suggested you could secure the knife to the hand with some bolts and wing nuts. Simple, clean, scary. It will probably take Congress to deal with some issues, such as if a skeleton should be allowed to have a loaded gun. On the one hand, an armed skeleton is scary, no doubt. But what if a dog digs up your skeleton? Even if the dog doesn't get shot, it could drag the skeleton around as it fires randomly in all directions, and no one wants to see that. I wish there was some magic formula for producing a scary skeleton. A lot of times it comes down to common sense. A terrifying skeleton that instantly crumbles into dust, and then the dust is blown away by a special fan that runs on solar power, might sound good on paper. But in the end, a few nails pounded into your skull at the right angles might achieve a more effective result. The main thing is, try to avoid cliches. Ask yourself what you find scary in a skeleton. Or ask your kids or your grandkids. Then build on that. I can't reveal what I've decided for my skeleton because that might hurt the scariness. All I can tell you is that if you plan on opening my coffin, you better bring one of those heart reviver machines. And I guess bring a blind guy, too, to operate the heart reviver. P.S. Maybe they have oil lanterns 100 years from now because there was a nuclear war or something, and electricity became extinct.
Jack Handy's latest book is the novel The Stench of Honolulu. You can hear a lot more stories by Jack at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, the choreographer Twyla Tharp's work is performed by dance companies all over the world all the time. She's so good that one time, for the movie Hair, she got the horses to dance.
And, of course, I did not teach them our steps. I taught the dancers the horses' steps.
I'll talk with Twyla Tharp just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Let the sun shine. Let the sun shine. The sun shine.
You are still listening to Studio 360, and I am still Kurt Anderson. Because we like you, we're always looking for ways to get your creative juices flowing. Over the summer, we teamed up with the comedian and actor Nick Offerman. He played Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation, and it turns out that, like the character, Nick is a woodworker and patriotic American. He challenged you to build something out of popsicle sticks based on some of his favorite things. Bratwurst, fishing, masonry, the band Wilco, the Hoover Dam, puzzles, and America, which is a fairly wide range of possibilities. And we got some great entries, and I've got Nick Offerman on the phone from some celebrity hideaway where he's going to announce the winner. Nick, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I'm deep in the bowels of my wood shop in Los Angeles.
Really? How meta of you.
I did not plan it this way. I'm actually packing up my ukulele kit to send to Boston so that I can build ukuleles while I'm there working on a play this fall and winter.
So this maker thing, you never stop.
No, many of our spouses would consider it a sickness.
Yes. out of our dozens of entrants, what were some of your favorites?
First of all, I'm just so grateful so many people sent in their entries. I knew I would be bowled over by the creativity, but there's some real standouts. There was an entrant named Steven made a beautiful bald eagle carrying a bratwurst.
Yes.
Talon.
Yes, I saw that.
There's an incredible diorama from a fellow named Nathan with a huge American flag and a little stick, like a doll of me fishing at the Hoover Dam.
Wow.
And I have a bratwurst on my fishing line.
Wow.
That was very inspirational. But the clear champion of this throwdown is an entrant who goes by the name of Nick Morton. He made an entire woodworker man figure from the belly button up. He's holding up a glass of scotch with a little too much ice in it. That would be maybe one small point against Nick, but it's a beautiful glass of scotch held up like the torch of liberty, and it's a lamp. It lights up. So that's the cherry on the cake, or is it? Because then the whole thing spins around on its axis, and inside is a secret lit-up vault cave that houses a bottle of scotch and some tumbler glasses.
Yes.
We asked for an item, and he made a museum.
He really did. And, of course, the fact that he shares your first name didn't have anything to do with being the winner.
It may have lent even more charisma to an already heroic entry.
Yeah. So, Nick, let's call Nick up and tell him he's won.
Okay. Hello?
Hi, is that Nick Morton?
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I have Nick Offerman on the line, actually, with me. So, Nick Offerman, take it away.
Hello, Nick.
Yes, Mr. Offerman.
Congratulations on your incredible creation.
Thank you. Thanks.
It's astonishing. I would not recommend tasting colored resin, which is what you used for the scotch. I tried it, and it did alter my mood, but ended up in a headache at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's not advisable.
And by the way, Nick Morton, we've buried the lead. You're the winner.
Awesome. That's really cool. That's awesome. And that vindicates the last 3 weeks of work, so my wife will stop looking at me crazy. So.
Well, you're going to have a really gorgeous lamp made by young Jane Parrott here in my shop.
That's awesome. Thanks.
And Nick Morton, had you ever worked in popsicle sticks before?
No, I'm a woodworker, so I build furniture. And normally it's easy to answer the question, hey, what are you working on? But when you're building a 4-foot-tall statue out of popsicle sticks, it's kind of, you kind of hedge a little. You're like, oh, you know, I'm just doing this thing. So.
How many popsicle sticks went into it?
About 2,500 from my estimates.
So that's like $100 worth of popsicle sticks. I'm obsessed with the cost of popsicle sticks.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that much. The hot glue is what gets you. I probably went through about 200 glue sticks.
And you said it took you 3 weeks. Like, how much time during that 3 weeks did you spend on this magnificent creation?
So I was trying to estimate. I think I averaged about 11 hours a day, you know, plus or minus, and that's every day straight. I'm finishing out my master's, so I have some free time.
Well, thanks so much to both of you, Nicks. Nick Offerman for thinking this up, and Nick Morton for building such an amazing thing.
Absolutely, my pleasure, and congratulations, Nick. That's a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
You can see pictures of that winning entry in all of its glory at our website, studio360.org, as well as images of all of the other entries. Who knew there were so many popsicle stick craftspeople out there? Thanks to all of you. Twyla Tharp is probably the most famous living American choreographer. And 50 years after her first dance piece, she's still making new work. Her company is touring America right now in honor of that semi-centennial. One of the things people love about Twyla Tharp is that she's a serious choreographer who also unabashedly loves and uses pop music. In 2002, she won a Tony Award for the Broadway musical Movin' Out, with a score consisting of Billy Joel songs. And then she created another excellent Broadway show based on one of her earliest musical inspirations.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow.
My mother considered Sinatra to be the
end-all and be-all of popular singers, and I don't disagree with her. I have listened to some of these songs literally thousands of times by now, and I still feel that there's an emotional content in them that matches the musical ability the man had.
My finger, lucky me, can't you see I'm in love?
Back in 2010, Twyla Tharp came in to talk about Come Fly Away, her show built around Sinatra songs. She'd started listening when she was a kid growing up in Southern California.
I grew up in a strange family.
Didn't we all?
Yes. But for my purposes, mine is more useful probably than having grown up in yours might have been. I grew up in a drive-in theater, for one thing.
Literally?
Which, yes.
Your parents ran it?
Yes, they owned it. And
cool.
I know. I started working there when I was 8 years old.
This is in Southern California?
Southern California. I worked there until I went away to college regularly, saw all the films, and more importantly, saw all the films often with no sound because I would not be in a car where the speakers where I'd be outside watching the big screen. So I learned to read action. But that was after already having endured my brothers and sister. My brothers are twins, and my sister was born 3 days before they were a year old. And essentially, they lived in the same room, and they were triplets.
Younger?
Yes. And they
evolved. You seem like an oldest child to me.
Yes, thank you. And they evolved what's called Italalia. They developed a sign language, and they created their own language, which they spoke, so-called, before learning any language. And when they started in grade school, they couldn't speak English. They could speak Italalia, which was mostly sign language. It was movement. And I was the family translator between the parents and the siblings. And so I learned to read movement.
Is that why, with this show, as in your other – most of your other work – on Broadway, you work without a book and a story and dialogue, but stick to the music and the dancing?
We have a book, we have a story, and we have dialogue. They are not spoken. The book is a series of action that transpires in exactly the way that silent film functions. The dialogue is when in a duet there is a conversation that is silent between the two partners.
So you decide, here's the 20 songs here, or how many ever songs there are. Here's the order, and then you figure out the story you're going to tell.
Yes
them.
And no. I mean, basically, I try to start that way. There will be changes,
sure.
Obviously. But there's a lot of balancing to be done because in this show, there are four couples whose relationship evolves. So that the pacing of the action had to be very carefully balanced, the right songs found for the right couples, and then the right sequence found so that there would be an overall musical pacing for two acts.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
There's a great sequence when a female dancer is tossed all over the stage by three male dancers. Seemed to me this fantastically sort of virtuoso, athletic, but effortless seeming Twyla Tharp kind of moment. Do you have that in your head as you hear that song? How does that work in the making of this show process?
It's a pun, which I love to do, a little because of the three little ones, the triplets. Fly me to the moon. Okay, let's fly this girl. So we toss her and turn her and we lift her and we swoop her and we swing her. But it's also a genre for me, a kind of partnering that I have worked on throughout the years of a single female partnered by a number of men. And how do you do this? Just as a bare bones sort of technical matter.
And then about midway through the show, there's this downbeat, introspective solo danced to this song.
As a man who has always had the wandering ways, now I'm reaching back for yesterday. Till a long forgotten love appears.
That's the September of my years. Can you describe what your dancers do?
Okay, this is a gorgeous performance. I think that obviously it's in many ways it's the most profoundly moving of the songs in the evening, and it's danced by the character who's called Sid, who is an older character. And this kid, who is an amazing dancer, Charlie Hodges, it bounds about the stage and jumps and lifts and turns and can do anything
He's young.
And you see our character, Sid, go to the center of the stage. And this is a monologue. This is his response to the sense of, well, yeah, you're no longer so young, guy. And the girls aren't coming to you, are they? And he's grounded. He's more weighted. And it's a very, to me, moving moment because it's a great dancer who I love very much, who I've been working with for over 20 years. And it's true. It's the September of his years. And what he's able to do, he's able to do at the peak of his abilities. He's an amazing dancer technically, but he has a maturity that is very rare.
The golden warm September of my year.
You've also worked in film, and one of my all-time favorite scenes in film is in Hair, which you worked on, where these horses in Central Park dance. How do you do that?
Well, how you do it is first you have the idea, which was Mike Weller and Milos were working on that script for probably nearly a year. When I started to work on the picture, and I worked on the script with them for a year before we started shooting.
Really? They let you work on the script?
What do you mean, let? It was part of my job.
Okay.
No, and they were very generous about it. I didn't know much about structuring a scene, but I knew that if you're in the park and you want to try and elevate the naturalism into the musical world, how do you kick it into song and dance?
Well, somebody's on acid.
The best thing to do, particularly if you're a bunch of hippies, is have the horses under the authorities start to dance. So they like that idea, and we got dancing horses. But
You just order up dancing horses?
Yes, they're special.
Really?
Lapis owners, right? And they're a special breed, and they're trained to perform certain rhythmic maneuvers. And, of course, I did not teach them our steps. I taught the dancers the horses' steps, who were pre-trained and flowing into us.
Do you think about how and where your work will be performed 50, 100 years from now?
Very definitely. I'm very involved with archiving and with education. I often say dance is the only art form without an artifact. It has no score.
Right.
It has no text. It has no painting.
And that's left a fraught history.
It is, yes. It's also, might I point out, the oldest and the most original of art forms, because you cannot do anything until you can move. You can't write a song. You can't paint a painting. And dance has a huge, long history, but it's not been recorded nor documented, and that's no longer necessary. It's not just a thing that's ephemeral. It does have a container. Video obviously has made this possible, but video is deceptive because that's only one performance. And so I have a very extensive video archive. I started in 1969, and there are thousands of tapes.
It's interesting. In 1969, you were doing this. At age 26, you knew that you were going to be a world-class choreographer for the ages?
I graduated from Barnard College in art history.
Still?
Listen, by age 26, I'd done a lot. My mother's name is Liesl, and I think of her as the equivalent of Wolfgang's father, Leopold, and had somewhat of the same kind of constructed childhood. So by age 26, I'd been working already and making dances since I was 4 years old.
And I guess as the oldest child, you become an adult at, like, age 10.
Yes, an adult when they were born. I became an adult when they were born.
Twyla Tharp, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Twyla Tharp's 50th anniversary tour is going on right now. The company is in the South this week and the Midwest next. You can find out where to see them at studio360.org. And by the way, 2015 is also the centennial of Frank Sinatra's birth. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening on the air or as a podcast. In fact, if you listen on iTunes, I'm hoping you'll do us a favor. Rate this show on the iTunes site. It's actually an incredibly helpful way to get the word out about the show. Thanks. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
And I'll write your name.
Ever wonder why pop songs are so irresistible? Turns out there's a recipe.
It's a bit of a high fructose song where you need something really exciting to happen every 7 seconds.
The writer John Seabrook reveals the secret ingredients behind the hits. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.